dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has been in the trenches of one of the most important battlefronts in that war, namely here on the home front, the war, I believe, is best characterized, or the battle space of the Trump presidency, and whether it would survive the kind of onslaught that has been thrown against it in recent years, going back, in fact, to before there was a Trump presidency. His name is Bill Marshall. He is a senior investigator at an organization that I would argue has done more to help us understand what's going on here than just about anybody, certainly in the private sector. It's Judicial Watch. And the investigations that Bill has been conducting and his colleagues have there have been of incalculable help. He writes about them on occasion in places like Town Hall and The Federalist. He visits with us from time to time, for which we are very grateful. And I'm particularly keen to pick his brains in the aftermath of the release just yesterday of the Mueller report, this long-awaited document that is supposed to tell us everything we need to know about Russian collusion with the Trump campaign and the transition to the presidency and then the Trump presidency. And Bill Marshall, it's really good of you to take some time. I know how busy you are, but I'm very, very keen to hear what you think of this report and its findings, and then to talk about what needs to be done next. Welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Frank. It's good to be back with you.
So what did you make of the finding? It seems pretty clear that Bob Mueller was persuaded there was no evidence of collusion, certainly anything that would rise to something that could be charged. Is that the end of that, as you see it?
Well, you and I have talked for probably years now about this whole operation. In my view, the Mueller investigation was never really an investigation at its core. It was a political operation to smear a president, right? To undermine a presidency, to paralyze it. And this document, I have not had a chance to read the whole thing. As you know, we've really been buried in looking at the players in the anti-Trump conspiracy here, and I'm up to my neck in records. But from what I have been able to read of it, it's filled with innuendo. You know, in the very introduction, it talks about numerous links between the Trump campaign and Russia. Okay, now that's saying a whole lot of nothing, really. Because as we know, the Mueller team came up with zero, zilch, nada, in terms of actual conspiracy between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. They throw out phrases here, these weasel words and these weasel phrases, to cast a pall over the Trump presidency and the Trump campaign before that, suggestive of some kind of nefarious dealings between Russia and the Trump campaign, when in fact there were none. I mean, this man has been investigated out the yin yang, and in fact, Attorney General Barr in his press conference yesterday seemed to go to great lengths to emphasize that President Trump didn't invoke executive privilege, didn't withhold any records. He turned over everything that was asked of him. There was no attempted obstruction. And there's, of course, it's even arguable as to whether he could be charged with obstruction, given that his firing of James Comey, which prompted the obstruction charge, was completely within his purview as president, since Comey, as director of FBI, reported to him. You know, the president has plenary power over his appointments in the executive branch. So this document, in my view, is just meant to damage the president. Going into his reelection in 2020, that the Democrats will undoubtedly selectively, cherry pick phrases from it to attempt to damage him in his reelection. And I'm very cynical about the purpose of the investigation and its ultimate product in this document.
Well, and its conduct in between, needless to say. And who was doing the investigation? And this is really one of the key points that it seems to me we've got to drill down on, how this came about. You know, the president has said we need to investigate the investigators. You've been doing that, Bill Marshall, you and your team at Judicial Watch. Give us a bit of a flavor of the sorts of things that are red flags supporting your contention that the Mueller special counsel operation, but before that, what was done in the name of a counterintelligence operation that gave rise ultimately to this special counsel gambit that really argues that there's wrongdoing on a massive scale. And maybe we should start with the cover-up of the Hillary Clinton collusion with Russia and her other misdeeds.
Boy, where do you start? I mean, there was a massive crime committed, but it wasn't by Donald Trump. It was by Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration officials working in concert with Fusion GPS, Christopher Steele, agents of foreign powers. Okay, and I believe the British intelligence services who were involved in engaged in what I still argue is the worst crime committed in American history, and this was this attempt to subvert the opposition party's presidential candidate using the technological resources of the federal government and abusing the laws in place that are designed to protect us from foreign threats. So, yes, we should be looking at the genesis of this counterintelligence investigation. The whole Operation Crossfire Hurricane, which went after, supposedly was created to investigate, to be a counterintelligence investigation to investigate collusion between Trump and Russia, but also the burying of the real crimes of the Hillary Clinton server case, in which you had special access program, top secret material being trafficked on an unsecure server, which was being diverted from the beginning of her tenure Secretary of State to China, if you believe Representative Louis Gohmert. These were truly colossal crimes. And one of the things that we're looking at, which I'll give you a little flavor of, we'll be issuing a press release soon on this, but our new documents we've gotten from James Comey's archives, which indicate that they were closely looking at John Deutsch's crimes in the run-up right before President Trump's inauguration. And I've just, for the first time, honestly, been looking at the CIA OIG report into John Deutsch's abuse of national security information, and I am floored by what I'm seeing.
Hold this thought. We'll be right back with more with Bill Marshall of Judicial Watch. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are visiting with Bill Marshall. He is the senior investigator at Judicial Watch, an unbelievably important institution, particularly because of the kind of investigative work that Bill Marshall and Chris Farrell and others on the JW team have been doing, especially in this particular area of where does the truth lie on the criminal behavior engaging, among others, the Russians to influence the 2016 election. And it turns out, as Robert Mueller has now, I guess, in his way, validated, it wasn't Donald Trump. So, Bill Marshall, again, thank you for your time today and for all the work you guys do. But you were talking a bit about what you've learned about the Clinton operation, both when she was Secretary of State and subsequently as a candidate. And I did want you to just sort of give us a flavor of, in particular, how did the investigators who were subsequently unleashed on Donald Trump deal with her? And the evidence of her engagement directly in the course of her campaign, not necessarily personally, but her campaign for sure, with the Kremlin to influence the 2016 election.
Right. Well, you know, Christopher Steele was supposedly, you know, obtaining intelligence from Russians, right? You know, about, of course, which ultimately became the product known as the Steele dossier, with the, as James Comey called them, the salacious and unverified claims about, you know, Donald Trump having, you know, a consorting of prostitutes in a Russian hotel, Moscow hotel room, and all this nonsense. So if we're to believe Christopher Steele has genuine Russian sources that are providing this information, and Christopher Steele is an operative working for Fusion GPS, which is in turn being employed by Hillary Clinton's campaign, then the real Russian collusion, and interference in the 2016 campaign was with Hillary Clinton and the Russians, not Donald Trump and the Russians. You know, so. One could also argue that if Chris Steele was actually getting this so-called intelligence from Russians, one has to ask the question: well, was this a disinformation campaign by the Russians, to inject ridiculous claims about Trump into our media stream, if you will, and into our electoral process? That would be a classic disinformation operation by the Russians, and no one should be surprised by that, by the way, given that Russia is a geopolitical adversary of ours.
Well, it certainly is, and that's part of what makes this so distressing, is that the evidence of an actual effort to help, or to enlist the help, I should say, of the Russians to try to defeat one of the candidates in the 2016 election has almost entirely been obscured because it was done by Hillary Clinton and her folks, not by Donald Trump. So when you look at all of this, just to sort of summarize, when you look at both what Peter Strzok and James Comey and John Brennan and others did to try to protect Hillary Clinton, and what they subsequently did to try to prevent Donald Trump from obtaining the presidency and then being able to use, the powers of his office for what our friend Diana West contends is sort of the counter-revolution, the effort to stop the kinds of things that Hillary and Barack Obama and so many others in the Obama administration particularly were beavering away at, a kind of revolutionary transformation, fundamental transformation, I think is what Barack Obama called it. When you look at all of this together, Bill, do you find that what was going on actually was an anti-Trump conspiracy using the enormous powers of the federal government in an unlawful way, compounding the unlawful conduct that Hillary Clinton personally engaged in and that of her immediate circle while in office as the Secretary of State? And in short, that there really is a need for a criminal investigation and, as appropriate, prosecution of those found to have, in fact, committed crimes.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you alluded to it earlier when you said that this is a massive deflection operation, that, you know, the whole Mueller investigation of Trump. The reality is there should be a Russian collusion investigation of Hillary Clinton and, the effort to generate this Russian-Trump collusion narrative, but also if you want to take it even further back, you know, looking at her Uranium One deal with the Russians. I mean, this was a colossal sellout of strategic U.S. assets, a 20% of U.S. uranium supplies to the Russians. That was approved by the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., which is headed by Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, while her Clinton Foundation was receiving $150 million in donations, so-called donations, from principals, from vested interests in that deal. You know, Frank Giustra and all that. So there should really be a huge investigation, a special counsel investigation of Hillary Clinton. And you know, now we're seeing, you know, we've seen these 8 criminal referrals made by Devin Nunes, which are hopefully going to be acted upon. There have been sort of intimations that a conspiracy of individuals could be, you know, a large number of individuals could be looked at. Should Attorney General Barr pursue that? And I sure hope they do.
Well, I just have to add, as we've talked about before, as troubling as the Uranium One deal was, what Hillary Clinton presided over with respect to the transfer of a host of militarily relevant technologies under the guise of something called Skolkovo, the effort to help the Russians obtain their own Silicon Valley, is to me at least as troubling, not least because what they were transferring, among other things, were hypersonic missile technologies that are now being pointed by the Russians at us. This is really treasonous activity at the end of the day. And again, it was used as a pay-to-play scheme. So, Bill Marshall, there seems to me to be plenty of grounds here, and I pray that it will be thoroughly investigated. I'm not sure I'm so keen on another special counsel, but on the other hand, we need someone who has the time, the resources, and the manpower to pursue this as least as rigorously as was Donald Trump's the pursuit of the so-called Russian collusion delusion, as Donald Trump puts it. Let me turn quickly, Bill, to just one of the many things that you've been writing about in your spare time, as it happens. And that is, you have an idea for what might be appropriate for Representative Ilhan Omar in the wake of her outrageous statements about 9/11. Talk to us about well, both what she said and what you think would be appropriate at this point.
Right. I wrote a column recently in a town hall called Ilhan Omar Should Visit the 9/11 Memorial and Museum, which I myself did for the first time, actually, a couple of weeks ago. And I'm ashamed to say it was my first time because I'm a native New Yorker. I grew up there in the New York City and left when I was 25. And I knew people who perished in the towers, both a firefighter and a high school classmate who was an executive at Cantor Fitzgerald, which lost 653 employees in that disaster. And to hear Ilhan Omar recently in a fundraiser, no less, before CARE, the Council of American Islamic Relations, which is, by the way, as you know, an unindicted co-conspirator in the terror financing, largest terror financing trial in history, the Holy Land Foundation trial that was presided over by Andy McCarthy. To hear her say in that speech that she gave that the 9/11 attacks were just, this is how she described it, somebody did something. That was how she minimized that attack, as though to divorce Islam and Islamic radicalism, if you will, from what happened on that day. You know that it was just outrageous. It was a callous, truly insensitive thing to say, particularly for an immigrant to this country who has been welcomed to this country, to be so flippant about the worst terrorist attack on our soil was just disgusting. And so in my column, I suggested that she make the same trip that I made to the 9/11 Memorial and Museum, and I hope that everyone else does. It is such a powerful moving experience, and one that I initially was reluctant to go to, but my wife convinced me, and we brought my son from West Point, and we just had a wonderful time, but a moving experience there. It just stirred up so many emotions, and it's such an important museum.
Well, I confess I haven't been there myself, but it's on my bucket list for sure. Bill Marshall, I hope it's on everyone's bucket list, and most especially Ilhan Omar's. It is time for us to recall who did something to us, and it was, I'm afraid, Sharia supremacists, who have a lot in common in terms of their ideology and their ambitions, if not their tactics, to people like, well, Representative Omar, I think it's fair to say. Bill, we'll leave it at that. Thank you very much for your time today and the extraordinary work you do at Judicial Watch. I hope that you will keep it up. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon.
Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's time for our tour inside the ring. That is where, of course, Bill Gertz takes us each week with his incredibly important prize-winning column at the Washington Times of that name. Bill is a national treasure who is also the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon. He's a regular here as well as an extraordinarily accomplished author, including as among his 7 best-selling books, the newest, I War, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
You have written one of your most important pieces this week, I believe, Bill. In the Washington Free Beacon, you called it U.S. Intelligence, Institutionally Politicized Toward Democrats. You're describing a very important essay along these lines by John Gentry, a 12-year veteran of the CIA. But walk us through, Bill, the most important of these findings, because few people understand the intelligence business better than you, both its strengths and its serious defects at the moment.
Yes, this piece that I wrote for the Washington Free Beacon on politicization of intelligence was based on a journal article written by Gentry, which talks about what was described as unprecedented politicization among intelligence officials and reflected in the views of former intelligence officials. Gentry makes the point that, like the military, active duty officials rely on former officials to voice their views and opinions. And here what we're seeing is, especially within the CIA, a very serious shift in the liberal direction. In other words, they're supporting the Democratic Party and also the liberal left-wing agenda. And he said that this is a very serious problem that needs to be reviewed, and we need to get a solution to it. We need to find a way to get back to objective, fact-based intelligence reports, or it's going to create real problems for the nation, which our leadership relies on a lot of these intelligence reports.
Bill, how did this come to pass? I'm struck by, you know, for example, the fact that John Brennan became the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, of course, under Barack Obama, but he was a communist, or at least voted for the national candidate to be president of the United States on the Communist Party ticket back before he became a new recruit to the CIA. Does it have something to do with the fact that the clearance and vetting process has clearly broken down, that we have this kind of politicization now taking place?
Yeah, in the case of Brennan, when he was a young man in 1972, he voted for Gus Hall, the Communist Party USA presidential candidate. He was a perennial candidate for president, and this obviously tells a certain thing about him. I think it was a case of that the agency over the years, it's always been somewhat a place for liberals within government to go, going back to the McCarthy period in the 50s. And then I think it just kind of mushroomed, especially under Clinton and Obama. And especially under Obama, Gentry makes the point that quality and excellence were subordinated to diversity and inclusion. So this was, again, through political correctness, and they changed the nature of the workforce. And the result is we've now got a institutionally politicized CIA, which, again, they have this view that their information should be solely used by decision makers. And if you diverge from that, then you'll see all of this massive leaking that we've seen, especially under the Trump administration, designed to undermine the president because he's not following their views and their policies.
Yeah. And Bill, again, the policy piece of this is the thing that I'm kind of struck by. It's not just that the politicization is providing a skewed portrait of the sorts of challenges that we're facing, but I can tell you, going back to my time in government, which was a long time ago, even then, the Central Intelligence Agency and to varying degrees other elements of the intelligence community, but particularly the CIA, were always trying to essentially shape or influence or redirect policy. Some of it with the intelligence findings they would serve up, and some of it, you know, more or less nakedly, you know, calling for such and such a policy instead of something else. Clearly outside of their lane, as the saying goes. Did Gentry talk about that as a problem as well?
Yeah, I think, again, he is mainly focusing on CIA headquarters. It's very interesting. I've gotten a lot of responses from former CIA officials who noted that in the past there was a clear delineation between the operators of intelligence, the collectors, those that are on the front line, those that are trained in the dark arts of espionage, and the headquarters staff, which, again, is kind of driving the train on what information is collected and what is done with that information. And what you find is that, especially under Obama, there was a clear effort to politicize the CIA by getting these predominantly liberal analysts and sending them down to the farm near Williamsburg and giving them a perfunctory operational training course. And then they could somehow think that they were these trained operatives, and they would make these people into station chiefs. And so therefore you kind of broke down the traditional barrier between operators and analysts, and the liberal analysts came to dominate the agency. I think that's kind of the main thrust of what he was saying. He doesn't get into the weeds of that, but that's been my experience in dealing with this issue of politicization.
And Bill, you know, there's a lot of noise, shall we say, that the politicization is the fault of Donald Trump, that Donald Trump is determined to get only the information that he wants. If he's paying attention to it at all, he's insistent that it be skewed to serve his personal, you know, biases and predilections. This analysis and your own experience, I take it, bears out the argument that this predates Donald Trump by many years, and it seems to be having the case that it's worse today, but not so much because the president is trying to manipulate intelligence as much as it's the folks on the left who clearly loathe him are doing it themselves.
Right, right. Yeah, I think one of the key points that is made in this journal article, it points out that Michael Morell, who was the deputy CIA director under Obama, kind of set the stage for this politicization, or at least the exposure of it. In 2016, during the presidential election, Morrell wrote a op-ed piece in the New York Times, and in that op-ed piece, he stated that my intelligence training tells me that Hillary Clinton is the best person to be president of the United States. And Gentry took him to task on that by stating that's not what his intelligence training told him to do. He was not trained to make political judgments about who people should vote for. And I think that's a really strong point. And again, we've seen that to extremes with former senior officials like John Brennan and like Clapper and even Michael Hayden, who wrote in his book that he had no qualms about stating his political views as an intelligence and using his gravitas as a former senior intelligence official to conduct politicization. And that's kind of what's a real problem. There had been an institutional culture for decades that intelligence officials were not supposed to play politics. And it raises some very serious questions about interference in the political system by people with access to some of the most sensitive secrets that the U.S. government has.
Yeah. And we were talking in the previous segment with Bill Marshall about the role that John Brennan specifically played in some of the anti-Trump conspiracy, for want of a better term, aimed at preventing him from becoming president in the first instance, and then essentially kneecapping him as he moved into the transition and then into the White House. John Brennan, of course, was very much a political guy, I think it's fair to say, while he spent time in the agency, to be sure. And he became more and more of a Democratic operative, no? And that translated into one of the most politicized directorships in the history of the CIA, I would argue.
Yes, and there's certainly questions about Brennan's role in triggering the unprecedented counterintelligence investigation of the president. Brennan has tried to state in his congressional testimony that all he did was basically hand over information from that the CIA had collected, again, from bogus sources, particularly the Christopher Steele dossier. He's tried to distance himself from that, but it's certainly, you know, and now we find out through Attorney General Barr that they, you know, there was perhaps improper spying on the Trump campaign and presidential administration as a result of this. And hopefully there'll be a big investigation. I hope that there's also a investigation of intelligence politicization. And I think I quoted Mike Pillsbury in the piece as stating that one of the places to start is by having the President's Intelligence Advisory Board, the PIAB, take a look at this issue and really take a cold, hard look and offer some solutions on how to change this and how to prevent this from happening in the future.
Bill, stand by. We're going to ask you to stay with us for another segment. We're going to talk about some of the important stories you've been covering besides this politicization of the intelligence community more with Bill Gertz, Inside the Ring, right after this.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Bill Gertz is in the house virtually. We're talking with him about what's going on inside the ring. This is, of course, one of the outlets that Bill uses to great effect to keep the rest of us apprised about what's going on in the national security arena. The column by that name at the Washington Times, as well as his work in the Washington Free Beacon, are indispensable for those of us who care about national security. And Bill, I wanted to just ask you about a couple of things that I know you've been reporting on. One is this bizarre story about a Chinese woman with a lot of electronic gear who showed up at Mar-a-Lago. What do we know about her and what she was up to?
Well, according to law enforcement sources that I talked to, this was clearly a Chinese intelligence operation. What happened was a woman named Zhang Yujing, 33 years old, came from Shanghai and claimed that she was attending some UN China conference at Mar-a-Lago, the presidential resort in Palm Beach, Florida. And basically what happened was the conference had been canceled. She knew that it was, and yet she tried to come in. Basically, she tried to crash this highly secure area that had been under intense security review in preparation for a visit by President Trump. This took place in late March. And she managed to come into the facility and said that she was going to go swimming, said a number of different things, said she was also there to attend a conference. And she basically fell through the cracks. And one of the reasons was that her name was the same as a Chinese member of Mar-a-Lago, which, again, has had a huge increase in Chinese membership since Trump's election.
Well, that might be a problem, don't you think?
Absolutely. And clearly the Chinese are targeting Mar-a-Lago. They know that there was also discussion of having a summit meeting, a second one. They had one in April of 2017 with President Xi Jinping of China. So my guess is, and the people that I've talked to said that this was a very unprofessional. The tradecraft involved was not professional. She carried two passports. She carried electronic devices. And it's very similar to a case that I also wrote about a Chinese student who was linked to the Ministry of Public Security, the internal security spy service in China. And he was arrested in Key West, photographing Naval Station Key West and some electronic equipment. And that, too, was also an unprofessional spy. So the theory is that the Chinese intelligence, the Ministry of State Security or Military Intelligence or Ministry of Public Security, police intelligence, are sending unprofessional spies on high-risk mission, maybe throw away people that could be caught. But they might succeed in planting a listening device, or they could be on there to conduct assassination operations, poisonings of not the president, but some of his top aides. So those are the concerns. Another thing is that they could be testing the security defenses by sending these people in. They can learn how the U.S., especially the Secret Service, and in the case of Key West, the military security, how they respond to intelligence collectors. And by doing that, they can figure out ways to defeat those security measures.
It would, I think it's fair to say, Bill Gertz, based on your reporting and a lot of other anecdotal evidence, be a very serious mistake, though, to consider this kind of unprofessional conduct as evidence that the Chinese aren't up to world-class espionage and collection operations, right?
Yes, absolutely. They are at the top of the food chain when it comes to human intelligence gathering as well as cyber espionage as well. So they're blending both technical collection and spying electronically as well as a very robust human intelligence gathering capability.
So, Bill, just to wrap that point up, as you look at what's going on at the moment, should we be concerned that Chinese nationals are actually members of the club, Mar-a-Lago, and having access to it under circumstances that might be less carefully scrutinized, say, than somebody who's not a member trying to sneak in, especially with a bunch of incriminating gear?
Absolutely. At this point, anybody can join the Mar-a-Lago club with a $200,000 membership fee. So there definitely needs to be something done. Again, this is the president's club, so he probably has some sway over who can become members or the vetting process to use to scrutinize membership there.
Bill Gertz, very quickly, let me ask you about two other topics. One, you're reporting on some thrashing going on Capitol Hill about President Trump's plans for a space force. How is that looking at the moment, which, against the backdrop of what we've been discussing about China, is a very high priority, as I see it?
Yes, there was a hearing recently in the Senate on with senior defense and military officials who looked at the costs and utility of creating a new intelligence space force. And there was a lot of skepticism on the part of a number of senators who asked, is this going to create more bureaucracy? And that's always been the issue. The Pentagon has already going forward to create a new space command. That is a unified combatant command. Although we have no space weaponry yet. I mean, we have weapons that are capable of being used in space, but they haven't been equipped and trained for that mission. So it's almost premature to set up a space command if you don't have forces that are ready to fight in that. But that's really the best structure right now. And they're also calling for creation of a space force that would be an Air Force component in the way that the Marine Corps is a component of the Navy. The Space Force would be a component within the Air Force, which has the predominant mission for space defenses and space offenses. And then the question is, do we really need this? It's going to be a large funding for that. And of course, this is one of the president's favorite priorities, creating this Space Force. So a lot of the senators were skeptical. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Joseph Dunford, was the most supportive in saying, look, we now have a chance to get ahead of this threat rather than responding after a failure, in reference to 9/11, when the entire military and defense structure shifted towards counterterrorism in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. In this case, he's saying we need to develop space forces and a space command and space weaponry before there's a conflict in space, which can literally decimate our society through knocking out satellites.
Yeah. Bill, from deep space, let's go to deep sea. Tell us about the latest assessments of the challenges that we're going to face in the underwater domain.
Yeah, in my Inside the Ring column this week, I report on China preparing not just to wage war in space and in cyberspace, but also in deep sea. And this was revealed in some Chinese military writings by two authors who said that deep sea is going to be the new battleground for China. They're going to develop robotic submarines. They're going to develop military forces that will operate in the deep sea environment. Deep sea is considered 3,300 feet and deeper. And of course, it's a very difficult environment because of the pressures. It's dark, it's cold, but it offers some stealth advantages, especially in as it relates to undersea warfare. And here we have the Chinese announcing that they're going to militarize the deep sea with a new set of weapons. They've been conducting a lot of research on conducting weaponry, such as planting missiles at the bottom of the sea that could be used to fire off. Actually, they also referred to underwater aircraft carriers, but no real details were provided on how that would work. But it certainly raises a lot of questions about these new exotic deep sea weapons.
Yeah. Well, the trouble is that it seems as though there is really no domain in which the Chinese are not beavering away at mounting dangerous threats to our forces, our personnel, and our nation. And what you've just reported, Bill, in your inimitable way is yet another one that warrants our careful study. Bill, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for giving generously of your time today and for all the great work you do. I know you'll not deviate from your chosen path, which is to keep us all apprised and safe. Thank you for doing that. Come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will do the same on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.